So what I'm going to do is just give you a broad overview of some of the work that a whole group of people that are collaborating on these two species are doing across the GYA in Montana. I'm not going to present a lot of results, but a bit of, on the history of these two species and the challenges to restoration, and then why we might need to have some collaborative research and then I'll give you tidbits of some things that I think are kind of fun that have just come in more recently. So hopefully you'll find it informative. So I'm going to start out a little bit by the history, and I'm going to put a big plug in for a book that was produced by Dr. Harold Picton, who's sitting here in the audience. He's a retired professor from our department, and Terry Lawner, who was the chief of research for Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. If anybody's interested in the history of Montana wildlife and restoration, and you want something to be proud of as far as natural resource conservation, this is a great book to pick up. I think it's in every library, in every community in Montana, and so it's available. I'm not sure if it's still available for sale anymore, but I know it's in the libraries. So I'm going to borrow a bunch of graphics from this and information to lay some groundwork. So you can see the subtitle of this is Decimation of Restoration. So Montana's wildlife went through a really, really bad period of decimation. Initially, when European settlers came into Montana, they used wildlife primarily for subsistence. These were the very first people. They were taking wildlife for food and fiber just to get by. But from the 1860s through the 1920s, the development of urban centers, people that weren't living off the land in a subsistence way, generated a market for wildlife, essentially a commercialization of wildlife. And so market hunting began, and that's what decimated our wildlife in Montana and throughout North America, actually. I think this picture on the right is from a store in Helena. Here you see a picture of bighorn sheep on a typical winter range in southwestern Montana. And if you can imagine all the miners in Virginia City that needed meat, and the market hunters that were looking to provide that meat, animals that wintered on these low elevation grasslands and these foothills were very susceptible to market hunting, and indeed an awful lot of bighorn sheep probably got shipped over to feed miners, who decimated and eliminated many of our herds. The other thing that happened about the same time is the domestic sheep industry started moving into Montana. The cattle industry had already taken up many of the low elevation valley bottoms, and many of the sheep herds, the commercial grazing was done in the high elevation areas. And if anybody knows bighorn sheep habitat, you can see this historic picture is on an alpine. You can recognize that this historic picture is on an alpine meadow. So we put a lot of domestic sheep in the middle of bighorn sheep habitat, and it turns out these domestic sheep have a series of bacterial pathogens that our native sheep are naive to, that causes pneumonia and catastrophic epizootics of pneumonia that we're still struggling with here in Montana today. So market hunting and then competition and disease were the two major drivers of the decimation of bighorn sheep in Montana. This comes directly from the book, two distributions, the 1860s of the Audubon sheep distribution. That would be our prairie bighorn sheep. I don't think taxonomists believe that was a separate subspecies any longer. But you can see we had a large populations. Along the Missouri river breaks, and as well as up in the Yellowstone as well. And then the lower graphic shows you the distribution of the rest of the sheep a little later, 1890. So that was before things really got bad, and this is what they looked like probably at the bottom. By 1942, this was all that was left of our sheep distributions. We had two good populations, one on the Rocky Mountain front and one in Glacier Park, and then some scattered ones around the northern GYA, and not much left other than that. So the estimate is 1,200 animals were left at the low point in the 1940s. So this book talks about the restoration of all the wildlife species, and essentially the two tools that were very effective for most of our large mammal restoration was just simply to regulate the take on animals, regulate harvest, get rid of commercial hunting, and regulate or shut off all recreational hunting until the populations recovered, and then translocating animals from the last remaining populations into what we thought was good historic habitat. So pretty simple tools, but it took quite the effort by that first generation of Montana biologists to get the job done. And I'm going to show you how quickly they got that job done for a number of species. So there's a couple slides here. They're all the same. You see the historic distribution at the low point in the map, and you see a graphic that shows how many translocations occurred in each decade from the 1900s to 2010. So in the case of mule deer, a decade of translocations in the 1940s got us from whatever the population was at that time, no one knows, to over 300,000 today, and the entire state's completely occupied by mule deer. Pronghorn, 25 years of translocations from the 1940s through about the mid-1960s, and we went from an estimated historic low of 3,000 to over 160,000 today, and essentially all pronghorn historic range is probably occupied now. Mountain lions, switching away from ungulates to a big predator, bounties essentially extirpated mountain lions in Montana. From 1902 to 1910, lions were killed and reported presented for bounties in nearly every county in the state, but by 1930, even though the bounty was still on, only two lions were reported across the state, which pretty much indicates that they were completely eradicated from Montana. There were no translocations for mountain lions. We regulated the harvest, and we restored the prey populations, and lions came back on their own. So little different stories for each of these large mammals as far as restoration. Bighorn sheep, we've had a little different story here. We've had 80 years of translocations. We're still translocating bighorn sheep. And we've gone from 1,200 animals to 5,000 animals in the state, 5,000 to 5,500. So certainly a success in that we have almost five times as many now as we did at the low point. But that's a pretty sparse population compared to what we had historically, especially the successes we had with the other species. And probably more telling than anything is the size of these populations. 70% of the bighorn populations that we have in Montana today are under 100 animals, and almost all population demographers and managers recognize that managing small isolated populations this low is not a good recipe for restoration and success. So if you think about that historic data, then it seems like the response to restoration depends on the species. So we have things like predators that, with very little help at all, just some protection, their ability to disperse and occupy historic range is really phenomenal. We only had two introductions of wolves 2 years in a row in two different places in the Northern Rockies. And from those introductions now, 20 years ago, wolves have spread out to Northern California. They're down to Northern California. They're down to Colorado. Certainly, the state of Montana, Idaho, and Wyoming are quite full with very little effort at all other than protection. We have all the ungulates that had strong responses as well, the deer, the pronghorn, and the elk. But then we have this really weak response from bighorn sheep. So it would appear that species life history characters and behavior has a big effect on how well they respond to these simple restoration tools. And there's something about bighorn sheep, their ecology and their behavior, that suggested that they just aren't responding as well to these tools as many of our other critters have. So why is the distribution of bighorn sheep in Montana so restricted and the population so small when we've spent millions of dollars and we have almost a century of really concentrated work on these animals and millions of dollars spent? And the consensus is we probably lack the ecological knowledge to enhance those tools to do a better job. And that's where collaborative teams and universities come in to try to help, and we'll talk about that in just a few minutes. So there's lots of potential limiting factors that could be contributing, either singly or in combination, to the history of restoration. We can certainly have habitat problems. We've now restored all the big predators, so now these species are living with the full suite of predators that they haven't for over a century. Many of these populations were founded from very small numbers of animals, so there could be genetic issues. I've already talked a little bit about disease and pneumonia and the exotic pathogens, and then the behavior of the animals themselves. All of these things could contribute. So switching gears a little bit, mountain goats have a really different history in Montana. It's kind of interesting. They both are mountain ungulates occupying our mountainous environments mostly, although bighorn sheep are also in the prairies, but we have a very different history of mountain goats. Here you see the historic distribution of mountain goats in Montana. So they are west of the Continental Divide, a little bit east of the divide along the Rocky Mountain front and down in southwestern Montana, east of here and to about the Pioneers. But I bet you many of you are sitting there looking at this map saying, well, wait a minute, there's nothing around Bozeman here. Well, we have a lot of goats around Bozeman, but they weren't historically here. So if you think about what I talked about, bighorn sheep, and then where they many of them winter, and if you look at this mountain goat picture, this is a typical habitat for mountain goats. These kind of places aren't places that market hunters are going to go trying to export meat down to Virginia City to the miners, right? So because of the ecology and where mountain goats lived, they weren't susceptible, and they're in lower densities, they're in tough country, they're far from markets, far from transportation networks, so they were just never a target for market hunters. And so market hunting did not affect mountain goats to the magnitude that bighorn sheep were impacted. And so while we don't have good estimates of the numbers of mountain goats, at the low point, they probably didn't have much, there probably wasn't much of an impact, at least through the 1960s or 70s. But during this period of aggressive translocations, state agencies decided they were going to move some mountain goats outside of their native range into new areas as well. And so these are pictures from the book. You can imagine those mountain goats getting caught up in the mountains, getting put on panniers and put on horses and brought down out of the mountains onto a wagon and then taken to some other range like the Bridger Range or the Gallatin or the Madison Range and turned loose. But that's what happened during this time. And so here's what you see, the present day range of mountain goats. And so you see a lot more populations and a lot more areas of mountain goats. And so what we have around here are mountain goats that are occupying area that was not historic mountain goat range. So they're non-natives in the greater Yellowstone area. So a very different story about mountain goat restoration, if they needed it, or range expansion versus what happened to bighorn sheep. To zoom in now in our backyard, the GYA, these are the stars of the places where mountain goats were introduced into the GYA, primarily in Montana, in the northern rock, the northern GYA, and those seven locations, primarily in the 1940s and 1950s, a total of 170 were released throughout the GYA. There were two release sites down in Idaho in the Palisade Mountains in the late 60s and 70s. So a total of 170 animals were released. Well, when we started working on this project in the GYA, we gathered up all the data from all the agencies to try to get a picture of how mountain goats changed their distribution over time. And so here's the only data we have up to the 1970s, so it's pretty sparse. It probably doesn't represent the true distribution. This is what it looked like in the 80s as far as the data. 90s, now agencies are all doing surveys and looking for counting goats. 2000, and the current distribution of mountain goats in the GYA. So from these few sites, nine sites, 170 goats that started in the 1940s, we now have about 2,400, our best estimate is 2,400 mountain goats in the greater Yellowstone area, and they are expanding. Now, if we look at our native mountain ungulate distribution, our bighorn sheep distribution in the GYA, you see, the GYA has really strong populations of bighorn sheep. In particular, this area along the eastern GYA that extends from The Beartooth Plateau through the Absarokas and the Northern Wind Rivers is the largest metapopulation in North America. This is probably the strongest population of bighorn sheep in North America. At least 4,000 animals all interacting in a continuous distribution in a really large metapopulation. So an extremely important wildlife resource we have on that eastern GYA, the best population in North America. Now, if we overlay the mountain goat distribution on top of that, what you can see is in the northern GYA and the southwestern GYA, mountain goats and bighorn sheep are occupying the same area. And you can see those red dots percolating into those solid blue areas. And so they're now in the process of colonizing all those other ranges where bighorn sheep, that these core native ranges of bighorn sheep in the GYA. So that led all the management agencies, all three state agencies in the GYA, the Forest Service, Yellowstone National Park, Grand Teton National Park, to ask questions. What does it mean to have bighorn sheep and mountain goats in the same mountains at the same time where mountain goats are non-native? This is a picture from the Beartooth Plateau. I'm not going to tell you where. But that pile of rocks is a salt bait site that we set up on the Beartooth Plateau specifically to bait in animals in order to set traps on those sites, capture the animals, sample them for pathogens, and then put radio collars on them. And note in the upper left-hand corner the date and time. So this is June 29th at 2 in the afternoon. So this is mid-afternoon. And early the next morning, that same camera trap took this picture. So this is kind of visual evidence that goats and sheep are using the same areas. And so there's many questions about competition for forage, changes in alpine plant communities due to this extra herbivore, the potential that pathogens, these respiratory pathogens, are being passed between goats and sheep. And so all of those are unknowns because there had been no concerted studies of bighorn sheep and mountain goats. We know a lot more about grizzly bears and wolves in the greater Yellowstone area than we know about our bighorn sheep and mountain goat populations. So these two things that I've just presented, the lack of a really strong response of bighorn sheep to almost a century of restoration in Montana, and the expansion of mountain goats in the GYA led to two different studies. The Greater Yellowstone Mountain Ungulate Project was started in 2009 and is funded through 2019, and the Montana Statewide Bighorn Sheep Project started in 2013 and goes to 2019. So they're two separate projects, but all the methodology, all the approaches are the exact same thing. So this is really one big collaborative regional research project. So the Greater Yellowstone Mountain Ungulate Project involves 22 different professional biologists in different agencies and 5 graduate students. And it's funded, it's had strong funding, corporate funding from Canon. Yellowstone National Park started the funding, but a whole lot of organizations have come in over the time since then to contribute to this work. The Montana Statewide Bighorn Sheep Project involves another 17 professionals and 4 more graduate students, and that project's funded almost exclusively by Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, although the state chapter of the Wild Sheep Foundation provided some really important seed money very early in the studies as well. So these studies are all built around this idea of what makes a really informative wildlife research project that'll be productive for everybody and help inform management. And the ideas are pretty simple. You study multiple populations in diverse ecological settings, so when you learn something, it's useful for not just one population that you studied, but it's useful for populations across the broad region. They have to be long-duration studies because everybody knows that climate varies here from the growing season and the winters, and that annual variation in climate really drives a lot of dynamics, and one has to have a pretty long series of data to understand how the climate affects the interactions in these ecosystems. These are expensive studies, so when you do them, you better have lots of research objectives so you maximize your efficiency. And you should have multiple and competing hypotheses. Never be out to prove your pet hypotheses. So we make really sure that we never have a hypothesis that we're proving. We have multiple competing ideas that we're evaluating the evidence for. And they have to be collaborative because they're interdisciplinary. It takes a lot of money and it takes a lot of people and a lot of agencies to be involved in it. So these are the populations we're working on. This is the largest scale study that's ever been conducted in this region. We've got 17 populations across Montana and the GYA that we're working on. These are just the bighorn sheep populations here. And this is what our research program looks like. This is why we call it an integrated a research project, because you see that all of these individual boxes, we could have studies on each one of these separately, but you see that all the arrows that make sense if you follow this diagram around, all the arrows that link each box. So if you spend all your money and study one aspect, one of these boxes, and you don't know anything about these other things that are influencing that box, you're not getting as much insight as you do when you have an integrated study and bring in a bunch of different disciplines to try to study, you know, a broader set of processes that your animals of concern are dealing with. And of course, what we're really after is population dynamics. You know, what we want is robust populations that are growing, that are expanding their distribution, and that are doing well and don't need a lot of management intervention. That's a success in wildlife restoration. So everything feeds into population dynamics. That's what the managers care about. What's causing changes in population dynamics is what all these boxes deal with. So just to jump through these a little bit, climate and habitat, we've got everybody's read plenty of articles in the Bozeman Chronicle and heard on the radio about all different sorts of interactions of different processes that affect the quality of the habitat, the connectivity of the habitat for all the wildlife in the greater Yellowstone area and Montana for that matter. So these are important interactions to look at. Physiology, well, certainly how healthy the animals are, the herd is, has a lot to do with how well they're going to survive and reproduce. And physiology is one of the places where wildlife biologists have really been pretty limited in the set of tools that we have. So we can do traditional physiological assessments, like you see here in the picture of getting ready to weigh some animals to see what the mean weight is. We can draw some blood from animals and get some basic blood parameters similar to what you do when you get a physical. And a more recent technology that has been applied to large ungulates, in that lower right-hand picture, you see an area, our research biologist from Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, Kelly Profit, using an ultrasound on a bighorn sheep to measure rump fat thickness. And so that gives us an idea of how good the summer range is by how much fat that animal's taking into the winter for the sub-maintenance period when they're going to need that fat to simply survive. But this is a pretty limited set of tools we have. But Montana State University has a very high-tech lab that's primarily used for human health research, two machines called nuclear magnetic resonance machines. And what they can do is they can take a small sample of serum from our bighorn sheep or any other ungulate for that matter, and we can put it in this machine and we can get profiles out of that and perhaps get measurements of the presence and the quantity of about, right now we've got a suite of about 65 biological molecules that we can assay very cheaply and very quickly that are indexes of all sorts of physiological processes in animals. And so we're developing this technology to try to develop a health panel, a standard health panel that we can apply to wildlife populations when we capture them that'll allow us to know about their nutrition, their stress, their reproductive physiology, the state of the potential disease states in early stages. And so this is a new technology that we're hoping that'll add an awful lot to our understanding of physiology and the health of populations in the future. Genetics is something that's very important too, and molecular tools have just rapidly expanded in genetics. And you can see there's many questions that can be addressed on bighorn sheep restoration, in particular on genetics. We've moved sheep all around the state, and a lot of these new populations were founded from very small numbers of animals. So these translocations that we've had, we have questions, genetic questions about founder effects, small population sizes, which can cause inbreeding, population isolation, and then try and identify populations with good genetic attributes that might be source populations and perhaps populations that need genetic rescue by being augmented by other populations with appropriate characteristics. Native herd management, we're interested in keeping herds connected in those metapopulations so we can have those metapopulation dynamics. There's probably local adaptions. So the right adaptions to be out on the Missouri River breaks is probably different than being on a mountain range up near Libby, Montana, or a mountain range in southwestern Montana. So we probably have populations that are locally adapted through natural selection to their environments. And, of course, we've had about 120 years of very strong natural selection due to the disease pathogens that have been introduced in those initial domestic sheep interactions. And that's probably driven some shifts in genetics, hopefully for the better, for at least some of the bighorn sheep populations. So it used to be, up until just a few years ago, the genetics that we had, the genetic tools we had, we might be able to get, 20 genetic markers from a blood sample or a tissue sample, maybe a couple hundred. But over the last 20 years, there's been a tremendous increase in the ability of applying genomics and automated gene sequencing, DNA sequencing. And so we have the ability now to use a domestic sheep gene chip that costs millions of dollars for the domestic sheep industry to produce through genetic research. And that gene chip that can look at many genetic sites, sites on the genome of domestic sheep, well, it turns out 24,000 of those are also informative for bighorn sheep. So they're shared with bighorn sheep because they're related evolutionary-wise. So we're using this domestic sheep gene chip with 24,000 markers on it to address these questions of genetics in our populations. Disease is right there in the middle, and you can see lots of things pointing into that box of disease. And this is the classic traditional model for understanding infectious disease causation. It's called the epidemiological triad. So we have to understand the pathogen, the host, and the environment. And it's the interaction of those three things that cause disease. So here again, you can see that having an integrated research project, you can't just study the pathogen. You can't just study the animal. You have to study all three of these entities in order to try to have a better understanding of causation, especially of pneumonia, which can be catastrophic in bighorn sheep. And we've just learned in the last 8 years, also mountain goats. And so in order to address that epidemiological triad, then all of these other boxes around it have to be addressed too. So the way we do that is every time we capture an animal, we sample it for pathogens. We sample it three different ways. We take a little cotton swab, put it on a little wooden dowel here. I'm trying to get this pointer to go over there. On a wooden dowel with a flashlight, and we're taking that cotton swab and we're putting it right down in the tonsil crypts and swiping at tonsil crypts because that's where the bacterial pathogens are that cause pneumonia. A suite of the pathogens. We also put a swab into the nasal passages for a different suite of pathogens that are likely to be harbored in the nasal passages. And we also take a blood sample because if they've been exposed to a pathogen and mounted an antibody response, then we can detect the antibodies to that bacterial pathogen in the blood sample when we might not be able to get it from the swab. So if any of you have been in one of our bighorn sheep captures, you've seen us poking and prodding with these cotton swabs in the orifices of bighorn sheep and mountain goats. And finally, I'll just talk quickly or maybe a little more extensively about movements. We have a strategy. Telemetry is really expensive. The instruments are expensive, and it's really expensive to get our hands on these animals. Most of the animals we have to capture by helicopter. That can cost anywhere between $600 to $1,200 an animal, depending on how tough the place is. And so we have two types of telemetry. We have standard VHF, and then we have GPS collars. Well, GPS collars are great. They're really expensive, but they give us really fine-scale movement data, precise movement data that really tell us a lot about migration patterns and things like that, but they don't last that long. Well, the other thing we want to know when we collar animals is how well do they survive and reproduce. Well, VHF collars provide that information. They don't take much energy, and so they can last a lot longer. So what we do in our telemetry study is we put a GPS and a VHF radio collar on each of our animals. The GPS is the wider collar. You can see that black box on that GPS collar. Oop, keep bumping this. That's a program drop-off unit. So these collars don't talk to the satellites. They're just archiving data, you know, at four-hour intervals. Where are you on this date and this time every 4 hours, as long as that collar is operating, and it's being archived in a chip. And then at the end of that approximately two-year period, this little black box is programmed to open up the collar, and the collar falls off. And then we get the opportunity to go backpacking in some pretty interesting places to try to pick up that collar and get those data back. And we're highly motivated because you're talking about, by that time, $3,000 you've invested, and if you don't pick up the collar, you don't get anything for it. So the way this works is when we put the collars on the animals, the GPS immediately starts collecting data, and the VHF collar is quiet. We're saving the battery for 2 years. And then when the GPS collar uses up all of its battery life and the memory's full of locations, it drops off, and this is what we hope we find. That's a collar. You can see it down there in the gravel, and this is just an outstanding recovery because right down there is a road. And there's no cliffs between us and that collar. So we've got collars in the mountains right now that we've tried 5 times for, and we haven't gotten yet, multiple days each time. So they don't always look like that, but that's what we need to do. And so once we recover those collars, then the VHF collar turns on and gives us another 4 to 5 years of being able to follow that animal. We can get some coarse movement data, and we can also know how long it lives and follow up and see if it has a lamb or a kid by its side. So it's a way of getting a lot of bang for your buck for every animal that we capture in these very expensive operations. And telemetry, everybody who's attended a wildlife talk around here has probably seen all sorts of maps and seen video of telemetry data. It's extremely useful. This was a great technological development that came around in the 1960s. These are some of the migration paths in this map of some of the bighorn sheep on the eastern GYA. And this is how many animals we've captured. We've sampled for pathogens, and we put radio collars on in the GYA. And remember I told you this eastern side is a very big metapopulation. It was never extirpated. It's never been augmented. It certainly was depressed at one time, but it came back on its own. So this is probably the strongest native population we have in North America. And I want to show you some of the interesting patterns we saw from some of the telemetry data. So all the maps are going to look the same. So this is locations of 3 animals aggregating this map. The blue dots are locations that were taken in the winter. The orange dots are the locations taken in the summer, and the teal and the green dots are spring and fall. So here you sort of see what would be considered a classic geographic migrant. It's got these animals have a winter range, and they migrate across a reasonable geographic area to get to summer range. Now I'm going to add to this map now the elevation profile of those locations, and that's down here. So the blue shades are the winter periods. The white shades are the summer, and these are just the elevation of those locations for these 3 animals. And what you see is this: they're classic elevation migrants. So they're moving across the landscape, going from low elevation winter ranges up to high elevation summer ranges. What we think is the classic seasonal movement pattern for large ungulates in Montana. So here's 3 other animals that were collared on winter ranges up on near Lion Creek on the Beartooth Plateau. So if anybody's been up on the Beartooth Plateau, you know that's high elevation. And I just said those are winter ranges on high elevation. And you can see that they're also migratory. So they're geographic migrants. Right over here is Cook City. And these animals are summering on Pilot Peak and on some of the mountains right above Silver City. And so if we look at their elevational patterns, they are not elevation migrants. So they're geographic migrants, but they're moving from an extremely high elevation summer range, a very long distance, to an extremely high elevation winter range. These are what those winter ranges look like. These are all bighorn sheep at 9,000-10,000 feet in the middle of the winter. So that's a very different strategy from what we're used to thinking about for large ungulates. Here we have examples of four animals. Again, this is on the North Fork of the Shoshone. And you can see the summer and winter ranges are all intermixed. So they aren't geographic migrants at all. So they occupy one area, and they essentially move about a relatively small area and make small geographic shifts, and they're not migratory at all. And here you see that these animals are also spending almost all of their time at high elevation as well. Even in the greater Yellowstone area with its tough climate, they're living at really high altitudes. And then finally, the last map, this shows you, now I'm going to show you two animals that were captured the same day with the same helicopter out of the same group about 300 yards apart and less than 30 minutes apart. And the first animal was non-migratory, and it stayed on that, what we thought was a winter range, year-round. And the other animal that was caught right next to it was a seasonal migrant that did a big elevational, both a geographic and an elevation migration. And so now when you think about this metapopulation and think about what we see in these movements, now imagine 4,000 sheep distributed from the Montana border and the Beartooth Plateau to the Northern Wind River. And in that 4,000 to 6,000 animals, they're all doing things different. Now, isn't that a good way to buffer yourself from catastrophic contagious diseases? Isn't that a good way to buffer yourself from the localized winter storms, ice storms that you might have at low elevation or high elevation, that together, any given population might have some tough times, any given segment of the population might have some tough times, but they do so many different things across such a big area that together, that metapopulation is very stable and very strong. So these are the data we've collected thus far from our GPS collars and the GYA, and I'm just going to take a subset of those data and show you that those movement dynamics just from the elevation plots. So this is diverse. This is only about 60 of the animals. So think about this diversity. That ecologists have a new word for this dramatic individual variation and sort of life history strategies. When they see this in a population, it was first identified in salmon that we all thought just they spent 1 year in their natal stream. They went to the Pacific Ocean for 3 years and came back. Microchemistry has shown us that there are all sorts of life history patterns within what we thought was one homogeneous population. And those ecologists coined the word portfolio effect. Many of you probably, or at least some of you, are close to retirement ages, and you probably have an investment portfolio. And you know that the main strategy in an investment portfolio is diversify, to have different investment instruments in your portfolio, that when one's going up, perhaps another one's going down, but with all of those different instruments, all those different investments, that you get a constant rate of return. Well, this is the portfolio effect of having that individual heterogeneity in these mountain ungulate populations, these native metapopulations, that may provide resilience to disease, to all sorts of ecological stressors on populations that we won't have if we don't have this individual variation across populations. So I'm going to finish this talk with an experiment that's really exciting that's going on in our backyard. That illustrates two things: the problems with bighorn sheep restoration that we haven't figured out yet, and an experiment to try to do something different. So everybody can look at this and probably recognize this is a map that's centered on the Madison Range. So we've got, let's see, we've got Ennis Lake and Ennis over here and the Madison River, and we got the Gallatin River over here and Highway 191. So this is a very large mountain range going from Hebgen Lake all the way up into Spanish Peaks that we can see as soon as we walk out of here. And we have two native populations of bighorn sheep in the entire Madison Range. So everybody's probably seen, darn, sorry. Everybody's probably seen the bighorn sheep down by Big Sky, the winter range in Big Sky. And this is their estimated summer range in the Spanish Peaks. It's the only place we have bighorn sheep on the Gallatin side of the Madison Range. If you go to the east side of the Madison Range, the Madison River side, the only place we have bighorn sheep wintering is at this really high elevation area right up by Quake Lake, by Slide Inn, if anybody knows where that is. So we have a small population that winters there, and they summer up here in the mountains at a Taylor Hillgard area. What's wrong with the rest of the Madison Range? This is where these populations have been since restoration and active management started 80 years ago. So why don't we have bighorn sheep in the rest of that range? Do we think there's not habitat to support bighorn sheep in that range? At least on the Madison side. If you drive down the Madison Valley in the winter, this is the look at those foothill slopes on the Madison Range. And anybody that's been down there in the winter, I work in Antarctica, and a good test on whether my graduate students can hack Antarctica is to put them in the Madison Range in the winter to see how they can take the snow and the cold in there. These are all windswept grasslands. These foothills are all outstanding bighorn sheep habitat, and they're totally vacant. There's nothing in any of that area until you get all the way down to almost Quake Lake. So I think the habitat's there for bighorn sheep. So why don't we have bighorn there? We don't really know. That's the ecological insight that we don't have. Bighorn sheep do not pioneer like wolves, like lions, like pronghorn, like deer, like elk. They like to stay put. So maybe if we have a vision of having bighorn sheep throughout the Madison Range, we just simply have to put them there. And so for 2 years, we've had an experiment to do just that. So now we're zooming in on the southern GYA, and here's that wintering population called the Taylor Hillgard right down here. We're zooming into that area right there. This is the summer range. This is the only place we find a sheep there. So we've gotten, Fish, Wildlife, and Parks has gotten permission to move sheep up to Wolf Creek. It's not as far as we wanted to move from the native range, but it's where we could get permission because that's mostly private land on that side. So the vision here is to create a bighorn sheep metapopulation throughout the Madison Range by translocating animals from parent populations within the range and keeping them in the same range, but just moving them into different drainages. There's many reasons, many good reasons to do this, and we think we could possibly fill up the range. And instead of having two isolated populations of a couple hundred, we might be able to, over a decade, create maybe a metapopulation of 1,000 or 1,200 or 1,500. We think the habitat's there to do it. So what we did is on the Taylor Hillgard winter range, we set up a different kind of trapping system called a drop net that my next door neighbor that is the one that got me to come here and talk tonight, helped me design these mechanical release devices. This is an 80-foot net that we suspend over a bait site. And when we get a bunch of animals underneath it, like you see here, and not too many that are trying to come down into the bait, then we'll remotely drop this net on the animals. This is a really safe way to capture animals. And it's a really nice way for translocations because we get entire social groups that come in. So we're getting the dams and probably their yearlings and their lambs and maybe a few other animals. They're used to traveling together. So when you're going to try to move them to translocate them, taking entire social groups rather than picking one off the mountain here and there with a helicopter could make for more successful introductions. And so once we get them out from underneath the net, then they're tranquilized, then we work them up with all of our biological data. We've done this in the winter of 2015 and 2016, and this is Julie Cunningham. The most satisfying thing she says she does in her job is opening up trailers like this and letting bighorn sheep jump out on the vacant winter range and hoping to expand the population. So we've moved 74 bighorn sheep so far. We have a lot of volunteers that come in for this. It's a lot of fun for the community. We have tentative plans to move 25 more, and then we're going to try to establish some other release sites in the future and try to keep this going for the next 10 years and maybe restore bighorn sheep in a different way than we have in the past that we hope might be a little bit more successful. And so you can see this integrated mountain ungulate research project. We're hoping that what we can do is contribute to a better ecological understanding And that then that better ecological understanding then relates to conservation, management, and restoration. But beyond the ecological knowledge, what MSU does, what our department does, what our individual faculty are doing, is we're training the next generation of wildlife professionals. So you saw how many graduate students are involved in this project. When we have projects like this, we teach students how to think integratively. We teach them how to work in teams. And if we do a good job, then they go out to be applied managers. And then each one of those people have a 30 or 40 year career that makes a difference for all differences for all sorts of wildlife resources. So our real fundamental product are these young people that have a passion to put 30 or 40 years of their career into doing this kind of work on all sorts of different species. And that's why we enjoy the abundance of wildlife we have here in Montana today. A lot of our economic engine is because of the great environment we have, which part of which is built on the legacy of the public supporting restoration of our landscapes and reasonable conservation with reasonable economic activity as well to support a good lifestyle for everybody. And with that, I'll take any questions and hope you paid a little bit more attention to me than this group of photographers in Yellowstone Park. So, okay, thank you.